So I see two points to be mentioned. One is, in my view, we have to see when we propose a model whether there is some formation scenario for the stellar system we are talking about that lead possibly or plausibly to that collection of orbits, that kind of distribution function that we are using. Otherwise, we run the risk of using some exceptional model that may be interesting per se, but not necessarily related to the physical system we would like to describe. This is one point. And for example, yesterday I was mentioning that those simulations by people studying the process of collisionless collapse tended to come out with a specific qualitative picture that is inner part isotropic and the outer half of the galaxy with alpha around 2, alpha being defined as a local measurement of the pressure anisotropy. So you have we are a case where the envelope is radially biased and the inner part is basically relaxed. So if we depart from this picture, which I admit is a limited and one possible picture of what goes on, in my view one should provide also a formation picture to get to a different qualitative structure of orbits. That's one item. The other related point is stability. That is, if you consider this qualitative picture, and this is, I was saying, of the order of the half-mass radius, the turnaround radius for the anisotropy, you may consider models that are more anisotropic or more isotropic. What I mean, you can consider an anisotropic case where the qualitative structure of alpha of R is the same, but instead of hitting the turnover radius at around Rm, you try to do it like this, for example. Or you can go into the isotropic direction by taking the same qualitative picture, but say this is Rm, and most of the object is really as isotropic, and the radial envelope is really far out. Okay? All these would be consistent with the same qualitative formation scenario, so the physical plausibility arguments would go roughly in the same direction. However, it has been shown that things of this sort are not viable because there is a well-known instability called the radial orbit instability, that goes back to work done by Russian theorists like Polyachenko, Shukman, in the early 80s, by semi-analytical kind of studies first, and then this kind of instability was conferred by n-body simulations. What the instability does in a situation like this, that you may prepare even as an experiment in your numerical setup, is a violent evolution process by which the system moves into a non-spherical shape. That's one fact. The other fact that the system tries to remove the cause of the instability, that is the pressure anisotropy itself, and so it goes back into a more isotropic state. The two fellows here suggested a threshold for instability in the form 2kr kt where kr is defined as the total kinetic energy in the radial degree of freedom and k tangential is the total kinetic energy in the tangential degrees of freedom, because they are two. The two here again is that for an isotropic system, this would be unity. 1.7 means that you are radially biased in terms of pressure tensor. And the statement here is that if you exceed a certain threshold, and this is going to happen if you come to this situation, then the system will be radially, unstable with respect to the radial orbit instability. This scatter here is not by any meaning a statistical uncertainty, or it reflects an uncertainty that is the model dependence of what goes on. For example, recently in 2006, it was possible to construct models with this quantity up to 2.75, and the model was still stable with respect to the radial orbit instability, with a little trick, although it was not done for the fun of it. It was done as part of one of those simulation programs of collisionless collapse. Some of the final products had this high value of pressure and isotropy. Now, in all this complicated matter of discussing physical plausibility, that is not a well-defined concept, and I admit, and stability, that is a very complicated concept to study. That is, you can run simulations, but and that's helpful. And if you do it analytically or semi-analytically, it's one of the most messy problems I know of. In any case, in all this context, it would have been nice empirically to have a signature for systems that are that have a pressure tensor that is more on the radial side or on the tangential side in terms of anisotropy. And this signature, interesting signature, comes from line profiles. There is one expert, world expert of this, is there, that pioneered these studies. The idea is the following. When Tonry was giving the dark matter pressure anisotropy option, to explain sort of flat kind of velocity dispersion profile in some elliptical galaxies, this option would go into a situation of this kind. Here, let's say, we are basically talking about isotropic systems, and we insist that the slow decay is due to the dark halo. And suppose you take this view that tangential pressure is doing the job. When you work out what are the consequences on the shapes of the lines that are used in absorption to measure the velocity dispersion, you would notice that you can prove that the Gaussian type of line profile that would be in absorption, so the other way around, that is associated with this picture, under this interpretation, would be expected to have a squarish type of shape. So the Gaussian would be deformed into a squarish kind of thing. If you go to the other extreme and you say, well, let's see what happens if I make a system that is more radial and anisotropic with respect to what I was talking about, then this would go into sort of, simplifying matters, triangular kind of distortion. And so the nice point here was to leave aside all the discussions and do it empirically and check from the line profile shapes whether the real system would be in this case, or even in this case, who knows? The point is that in order to have a significant impact on the kinematical basic profiles like this, you have to include huge amounts of anisotropy to do a significant change in these profiles, so that you would really have a case where things like this should be found, or things like this should be seen. From what I understand, in most cases, the deviations from Gaussian profile are very small, hard to detect. They are there, so it's not a zero as a signal. But the entire story of the line profiles, probably, but Orting will tell you more tomorrow or even today, boils down to saying that the quasi-isotropic distribution functions are probably there. So I move on to point 13, because we have already mentioned dark matter, but I haven't said much of what one can do about dark halos. Leaving aside the nice tool of gravitational lensing, that is what I'm not going to mention, typically one looks for some kinematical tracers. Spiral galaxies have a nice H1 disks that are there in a very smooth and regular way in many cases to tell us exactly what is the circular velocity and so on. So the diagnostic there is extremely straightforward, I would say. In the ellipticals, H1 is typically missing, although there are some beautiful examples like I see, is it 2006? Like this year. Yes. The measurement was done not this year, but many years ago by Tim Deseo and Jacqueline Van Gogh. I may forget someone else who was involved. And in this case, there is an elliptical, and there is a lucky situation with a nice H1 ring. And so you have some kind of a smoke ring, and the elliptical is here. The ring is regular, the velocity contours are regular, and you have typically one data point of a rotation curve available for that galaxy. Using stellar dynamics in a sort of a cooperative way, that is using both models of the distribution function priority type that I discussed yesterday, and also other more direct diagnostics that at that time were called quadratic programming technique, if I remember well, by Herwig de Jong and so on. Some galaxies were studied in detail using stellar dynamics, that is, spectroscopy in absorption lines. One of these is this, which is a bright member of the Virgo cluster. And the interesting thing of the modeling and the diagnostics that came at that time, we are around 1992, is something like this. You build a model that may be criticized, and you can argue, because the system does not have the straightforward diagnostics of H1, so there is some model dependence going on. But there is a way of decomposing the dark and the luminous matter contribution to the distribution of matter that we are diagnosing. And what came out at that time was something in terms of rho that is very close to what was mentioned yesterday and mentioned by Tommaso the other day. That is, the picture will be consistent with the halo that is diffuse and with a distribution of luminous matter that is more compact. What came out a posteriori, that is not put in a priori in the modeling, was that these contributions for this subject added up in such a way that if you computed from the best fit model the equivalent rotation curve, that is the V as a function of R in kilometers per second, out to 50 kpc, I'm referring to the best fit model that is constrained only inside RE, basically, at that time. And RE is, at that time, was measured to be around 12 kpc. So the kinematical data points are here. They have error bars and so on. These numbers are this way because I think the distance was taken to be 20 megaparsec. If you have now a different best preferred choice of distance, you have to change the numbers a little bit. Well, the curious thing is that the equivalent velocity, rotation velocity, made up of the two contributions, turned out to stay around 300 kilometers per second within 10% out to here.
This is extrapolating.
Extrapolating. So it's even more surprising. In practice, the question is, since the data points are really hard only inside here, the statement should be stopped probably at this level. But since for one kind of modeling that was used, we were using global models, we said, well, let's see how it goes. And it goes like this. Although these models used had eventually a decay of R, of the density, like one of the R4. So you cannot say, well, you built in something that has a singular sphere, isothermal sphere. No, these, both for the M and for the stellar contributions, the asymptotic behavior at large radii for the two contributions was like this. But out of 50 kiloparsec, this was the finding. Now, we wanted to speak only half an hour. There will be more time tomorrow to say more about these things. Scaling laws. Scaling laws have been very popular from the 70s on, starting with Tully Fisher for spiral galaxies. The fundamental plane was born later. There are a number of scaling laws like Faber-Jackson and so on. One of the most recent scaling laws is the mass of the black hole sigma relation, sigma being the velocity dispersion inside spheroidals. And they have a common nice quality, that is, they put us questions about formation and evolution of galaxies, because they are there and we have to explain what they are, why they were set up. They can be used in a number of ways, like distance estimators, and also they are in one more way of putting this question that was to me, for example, signaled by the flatness of that rotation curve. You have it here in the sense that the scaling law typically includes a signal from the luminous part, and then you have one item in the scaling law, like velocities, that depend on the global contribution of dark and luminous matter. The fundamental plane is the one that is the relation that is probably the most important in our case of elliptical galaxies, can be written like this. With standard notation for RE, central velocity dispersion, mean effective, mean surface brightness inside the disk of radius RE. If these are measured in a standard way, in the sense of these in kiloparsecs, this in kilometers per second, and this in magnitudes per square second, the numbers would be, I have them, 1.2 No, there is an 8895 that I. Yes, and but quoting from Jørgensen and so on, the numbers would be plus or minus 0.1. This is alpha, beta like this. And gamma. This is using all the, I mean, within the paper by Jørgensen et al. 93. This depends on the wave band that you work with, and is something that is not often mentioned. But in any case, this is the situation. A comment that is related to this. The one thing that I didn't mention is that you have typically a statement that the scatter in RE is about 15%. What I would like to mention is this fact. If you take the virial theorem using quantities that are closed to those that are used here, you could write it in this form, where on purpose you use here the scale of length that is RE, that is the one that is here, and sigma naught that appears here. So in terms of the data, you can take RE to this side and put KV here. KV, you can call it a virial coefficient. And of course, it depends on the detailed structure of your system, and it also depends on whether there is or there is not dark matter and how it is distributed with respect to the luminous matter. So all the dynamics or the dynamical modeling goes into here. And you can do something like this. You can divide and multiply by L. So you have something that people that love to study stellar populations would like to put in, that is the stellar mass to light ratio. And you can use this and this equation this correlation as if they were equations, and you can try to eliminate sigma naught. And if you do this, you have a single equation that is like this. Some constant, but now I'm not hiding issues. It's really constant, like G, gravitational constant. And then you have something that goes like this. Let me see if I remember. 2 minus 10 beta plus alpha divided by alpha. And L. I'm not sure. No, it's not like that, of course. I think this is correct, and this is correct. One thing that by magic occurs, I use on purpose the word by magic because no one told me why it should occur, is that this, with these numbers, this combination is very, very close to zero. I don't know if I wrote down something. It comes out to be 0.04 if you use these central values. And then you can discuss about the uncertainties and so on. But it's a temptation to say, well, let's suppose it is indeed zero, because some physical law is there, and suppose that it is indeed zero, as it would be consistent with the measurements available, then this would go away. And you will have a nice relation between these quantities and L, and the exponent delta would be would be 0.064 propagating errors from there. So there are typically two alternatives. One is probably the one that is more popular and followed, and probably is physically more interesting, is to take advantage of the fact that the R1 quarters law seems to be a reasonable universal law, that the fact that all the measurements, at least for bright ellipticals, come out to be consistent with the density distribution, the total density distribution, similar to that of an isothermal sphere, and other facts that are telling us that probably elliptical galaxies are homologous. If that is the case, KV will be a coefficient that is really a constant, because structurally speaking, you are just rescaling these objects, but they would be the same. Then if this is the case, the fundamental plane would be telling us that there is a mass-to-light relation, one-to-one relation between mass-to-light and luminosity. And the mass-to-light we are talking about is a stellar mass-to-light. So we have to consult people that study populations to understand what goes on. The other possibility would be that, for example, for simplicity, the M star over L is approximately constant, and the burden would be on dark halos to be distributed with respect to luminous matter in different ways, in such a way that what goes on, I don't think we know. I tried once to look in detail into this problem, and I got convinced that it's neither one extreme nor the other. That is, the answer is in between. And that's one more conspiracy, because in spite of the fact that part of the burden is on stellar populations and part is on dark halos, the two get together to lead to a rather well-defined fundamental plane. So I'm basically over time. What were the other points? Many. As I did yesterday, I list them, and if there are questions on them, I can. No, I promise. No, we had to stop because there is the other. So the items would have been dynamical evolution and dynamical friction. Then there will be primordial or growing black holes. Then there would have been X-ray halos. Then yesterday it was mentioned that I should add triaxiality as an important separate issue. And then 19 was actually a question that may worry that low luminosity galaxies probably would be worth deeper studies or further understanding. So now I'm over time. Here I could have sketched something of the ideas behind this. The idea are the following, that people doing stellar modeling usually express themselves through equilibrium configurations that seem to be frozen forever and ever. That is, take a Hernquist model of some kind. In practice, the real system undergoes evolution. There are a number of factors that can be invoked to be responsible for that. And one of them is dynamical friction against satellites or even a system of globular clusters, for example. These objects have a central massive black holes quite frequently. Are these there because they were formed like that from the very beginning, or have been elliptical galaxies growing these slowly by adiabatic growth? At one point, the adiabatic growth of black holes seemed to be quite successful. People nowadays would think more in terms of mergers, and maybe you had to worry about what is the process of merging two massive black holes, what it would lead to. X-ray halos is diagnostics, but it's not only diagnostics, it's physics of what goes on around these objects. Triaxiality is important, and this is a question.
It's
No, I think there are knobs in the hierarchical scenario that you can try to fix in such a way that you're able to deal with.
Something that comes out in a natural way.
Yeah. I'm sure there is, even Chunpei Ma has been doing work on this, she was telling me yesterday. There are many, many pieces of work done all over the world to address the questions you're posing. If you ask for a personal feeling, I have the impression that so far these scaling laws do not come out naturally from cosmological simulations. That's certainly my impression.
Well, I think one way to make some progress on understanding that is to tie that to number 15 here, right? So to talk about mergers and whether it's gaseous or it's gas pure.
Yeah.
And I think the conspiracy here to me is why these two fairly distinct, very different processes would lead to the same plane. I think we have some understanding of why within each gaseous merger there's a dry merger, why within each one you get a right tilt. But why do those two give you the same plane is not understood.
But the idea of putting complete integrated picture is very, very difficult. For example, putting together fundamental plane here, these two. There has been a paper by Luca Ciotti, that we often mention, and Ciert van Albada. And apparently their simple argument of building, using mergers as building blocks of elliptical galaxies led to nowhere unless dissipation played a significant role in the merging process. So in a sense goes against this step that you were taking. So the entire thing is to me quite open, so the jury's out.
But you take another point of view, and in some ways, this is not very different from the burial plane, right? So burial theorem helps a lot. You can get it right toward the planet, you know, this small tilt away from the burial
tilt. I mean, there's the additional problem of the tightness of the scatter around this plane. Right? It's not just
That's right.
There's an issue, right? This is our band. If you look at K-band,
Yes. It's almost the other way around. If you go in K-band, you have almost a cancellation. So things are not even well defined as problems before, probably at this stage.
I mean, for example, this is elliptical. If you also go to spirals in K-band, then the whole scattering in, for example, through the fissure is due to measurement errors. There's no intrinsic scatter whatsoever.
Is that true, or is that for clean samples of spirals?
Well, this is a volume limited sample.
The study by Mark Ferrein.
There's no intrinsic scatter.
But to me, one major conspiracy that is a problem that we don't understand is going down to this. all the explanations I've heard, attempts at looking at ways to interpret these scaling relations, basically refer to a picture where we are talking about elliptical galaxies. I mean, bright elliptical galaxies. The items I try to define first as the pressure supporting systems. Now, in the fundamental plane, you have S0s, you have low luminosity ellipticals, and they all follow the same. So, I mean, we should be so have so much courage to claim that we have understood the upper part, and the same explanation will hold down to the other part with different physics. That's
I have a question, but maybe the answer is very long. So, does anybody know if bulges have the same kind of scaling relationship or connection to the scaling relationship like the fundamental plane? I couldn't find a clear answer in the literature.
I agree. There was a piece of work, sorry if I switch a little bit, but it's the same issue, I think. There was a piece of work done recently in Pisa as a thesis. And the person looked into the data of the fundamental plane for globular clusters. And it's very hard to convince ourselves that indeed there is such a plane, that the sample is treated correctly in a sense, because you have data coming from different measurements, different types of measurements, different people in different epochs. So collecting the data simply is not, and probably on bulges there are hundreds of measurements, but done one here, one there, not in a. And the late, that's right.
And the latter have a lot of rotational energy.
Yeah.
Right? So then you wouldn't
expect them to follow the same
relation. But they're really often three-dimensional bars.
Right.
But to see one sample separated from the other in a clean manner, probably it would be worth trying, but I haven't seen it.
But if you really think this is the real theorem plus the dependence on plus the latter population. Yeah. Dark matter mix, then you shouldn't put them on the plane plot because central dispersion doesn't have the same meaning as for
that's a point. For example, for the globular cluster system, if you treat the error bars that are claimed, sometimes not even mentioned in some of the articles, you treat them in one way or in another, and it's not done in an arbitrary manner. The person in Pisa consulted the authors of the various articles and tried to do his best. In one way, you get a continuation from the fundamental plane of ellipticals. In the other case, you get, instead of the fundamental plane, you have the fundamental line. The manifold comes a line. And so it's like a quicksilver, this kind of topic.
Yeah, I mean,
but in a globular cluster, for example, the sigma is well defined.
Depends, because there are measurements. There are measurements that are done on discrete stars, and then if you work on those cases where you have collection of discrete objects moving around, typically it's done just outside the center. Otherwise, there would be crowding. And then, since some of the concepts you like to explore refer to distribution functions and so on, those are one component models. You have one function that it's idealization. In practice, for these globular clusters, you have to take into consideration a superposition of up to five King models to describe the gradients in mass to light ratios that are present there. So it's really very complicated. Sometimes I have the impression that for galaxies we are happier because we don't know so much in detail the system.